You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, avocados are nutritional powerhouses which helped the fruit spread across the Americas millions of years ago. We'll learn about what makes it unique and why it's enjoying such a surge in popularity. Now, national political party conventions like the DNC and RNC coming up the next couple weeks are often used to inspire and energize the faithful for the sprint to the finish line. They're also a time to take care of some business and signal what a party's priorities are and which interest groups can count on their agendas being advanced. That takes the form of the party's platform, which is hashed out in the spring and summer of the election year and then generally voted on at the convention. There have been some contentious platform debates in the past, but most times they don't get a lot of attention these days. Our next guest says these documents can still provide strong indications of how federal dollars would be spent if a party came to power and who's likely to be at the table when big decisions are made. Margie Hershey is a professor of political science emerita at Indiana University. She writes and teaches about political parties, organized interests, and media coverage of campaigns and elections. She's the author of the book Party Politics in America. She wrote an article, What Are Political Parties Platforms and Do They Matter, for the conversation. Margie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
How have political party platforms changed in recent years compared to these hard-fought documents they used to be?
Well, they can still be hard-fought documents, depending on the kind of unanimity you have in a political party. The difference is that the parties themselves have become much more polarized in the last few years, which means that there is less and less disagreement within the party and a substantially increased disagreement between the two parties. So that has meant that having fights over the platform gets to be pretty high stakes, and they're avoided at all costs now.
Right. Look at this year. How have Democrats, for example, with some, you know, a range of policy options before them, how have they tried to hash out their differences without public squabbling?
Well, I think typically the way parties do this, the out party in particular, which the Democrats are right now, is to hold platform committee hearings around the country to hear from a variety of interest groups, to listen especially to the followers of whatever candidates have come close but not gotten the party's nomination. And I think that's been especially true of the Democrats this spring, that they've paid good attention to the concerns of people who wanted Bernie Sanders as the nominee, Elizabeth Warren, and others who at least had a reasonable representation in the primaries.
On the Republican side of things, we've seen the party officially say, we'll just keep the 2016 platform. And we've heard from the president and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, an important advisor in the White House and in the campaign, saying they want to have a much smaller thing, not a multi-page thing, but maybe almost an index card sort of platform. What do you make of the Republicans' approach to the platform this year?
Well, maybe they want one that President Trump is likely to read. I think that the Republican Party has had quite a few interesting changes over time in its platforms. If you were to read the 1952 or 1956 Republican platforms when Dwight Eisenhower was the Republican candidate, you would have seen that the Republican Party committed itself very strongly, very explicitly to civil rights laws, to equal rights and opportunities for women. There was nothing about abortion in the Republican platform at that time. That came in 1980 with Ronald Reagan. That was the first time that the Republican platform committed itself to a pro-life stance on abortion and started to become more representative of the evangelical Christian community than it is now. So we can really see over time changes in the platform reflect changes in the kinds of the amounts of power that different groups in the party's coalition have.
We're talking to Margie Hershey, political science professor at Indiana University, looking at party platforms, how they've changed over the years, and the role they play in politics. Margie, if there's an inquisitive, maybe undecided voter out there trying to really do their due diligence and figure out what each party and each candidate is all about, is it worth it for them to consider what's in the party platforms?
It is, Rob, although they might get just as good an idea from finding out from news sources what the platform says the party platforms have typically been upwards of 50 pages. And generally speaking, a good chunk of the platform is very broad and very general. It's to appeal to voters about the kinds of virtues and values that most Americans hold. About a third of the platform, maybe even a little less than that, is the really key part. And that is the specific promises that the party's platforms make to those interest groups that are central to the party's victory in the next election. So for the Republican platform, we'll see very specific pledges that have to do with, for example, whether or not judges will be nominated by the president who do not commit to a human life amendment guaranteeing the sanctity of all human life beginning at conception. In the Democratic platform, we'll see a variety of specific pledges that teachers' unions are especially interested in.
And that's a big part of these platforms, particular interest groups that make up, in effect, the coalition that constitutes a Democratic or a Republican party, trying to make sure their interests are on the table and don't get left out, even if their side wins. So how jealously do some of these interest groups watch that platform and make sure their language gets in there?
Oh, this is big stakes for interest groups, and understandably so, because this isn't like giving to the United Way. You know, being a part of a party coalition isn't just sort of expressing your love for America. You want something from that party in return for providing your voting support to it. And these groups have understandable interests that they want to see paid attention to, just as all of us do. If we were in a position to do the same, we probably would. So that means that these organized interests testify before the party's platform committee hearings. They often try to get members on the party's platform committee, or at least sympathetic members of Congress or other national officials who can speak for them. And they pay really close attention to what seems to be in the lead as far as getting into the party's specific pledges in its platform.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page if they pay attention to party platforms. Susie says, I look at both sides and their platforms. And Susie says the platform of the House and Senate is more important than the president. So is there, if a party comes out with a platform, is that in some way binding on the presidential candidate and their House and Senate candidates around the country?
In a word, no. The challenge here is that the candidates are decided in primaries. They're decided by primary voters, not by the leaders of the parties in the various states. I mean, the state Republican and Democratic chair in Indiana can favor whoever they want, but they've got the same number of votes in the primary as I do. So there's really no way that the national party organizations can bind their candidates to support the platform. And in fact, we regularly see instances where that doesn't happen. The thing is, I would suggest to Susie, the problem is that the two parties in Congress don't have platforms. I think what she probably means is paying attention to what it is that they actually propose to vote on in Congress. And that you'll generally find stated in the party's platform. As much as the party's platforms generally go unread by almost everybody, including quite a few of the party's own candidates, if you read those specific pledges, you'll find that if the party gains power over government, if there is unified party control, those platform pledges, about two-thirds of them, will in fact be at least attempted to be fulfilled over the next 2 or 4 years by that party. So they're pretty good predictors of what it is the party wants.
That's a good place to leave it. Margie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Margie Hershey is a professor emerita of political science at Indiana University. She's the author of Party Politics in America, and she wrote an article, What Are Political Parties' Platforms and Do They Matter, for the conversation. You can find a link to that over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll hear about an art exhibit in West Bend and Milwaukee that looks back the last 50 years of comics and cartooning in Wisconsin. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the curator of a new exhibit on the history of Wisconsin comics and cartoons. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of a legendary band and their iconic shows on the hillside.
The Grateful Dead played at Alpine Valley Music Theater 20 times in the 1980s. Fans trucked to the southeastern Wisconsin venue from all over the country. Producer Steve Gotcher attended most of those shows. On the day that turned out to be their last concert at Alpine, in July of 89, he decided to record the sounds of the scene in the parking lot. Here's what he found.
When I was 25, I became a Deadhead, a fan of the Grateful Dead. Up until then, I couldn't understand what all the fuss was about. So my friend Kevin suggested that I come along with him to a show at Alpine Valley near Milwaukee. He claimed that once I saw a concert, I would understand. And he was right. So from July 1981 to July 1989, I made my way to that hillside for 19 concerts. In the early 80s, most of the people who showed up had a ticket, with a few looking for a miracle. What started out as a loopy, easygoing crowd who followed the band over the summer swelled over the years into a much larger bunch who just came to party.
What?
You know
how to make burgers? Got it. Eileen, you know how to make little balls and pound them up?
It was the scene in the parking lot before and after the show that I found the most intriguing. So I decided to try and capture the setting on tape, wandering around the dusty parking area with my portable cassette recorder.
Morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how you doing?
All right.
What you doing?
Making a tape for a public radio documentary.
Oh, really?
On the scene.
Huh. Hi, Ed.
The Deadheads started filling up the parking lot early, grilling, drinking beer, playing hacky sack, and throwing the frisbee around. They were smoking, making deals, and listening to cassette tapes of past Dead shows. Sounds, smells, and colors swirled in a collage that overwhelmed the senses and appealed to my young hippie sensibilities. Camping wasn't allowed in the parking area, but you wouldn't have known it with hundreds of tents dotting the horizon as far as the eye could see. I found a few parking attendants, so I asked them what they thought.
We parked about 20,000 just on Sunday. That's before the concert even starts. So that gives you an estimate, it's more than 20,000.
Yeah.
And those are 3 dayers. And the people that come in the first day are usually pretty good. They don't bother you, and they pretty much do what you tell them to, for the most part.
It's not their fault they're not that bright.
Yeah. A little slow.
It's kind of.
But if you give them specific directions, they're okay.
Yeah.
People tried to sell everything from watermelon slices, beer, Gatorade, cigarettes, tie-dyed t-shirts, stickers, flowers, and some other things not found in stores.
50 cents a slice.
50 cents a slice for watermelon.
Give me 50
watermelon. All right, no, I gotta make a ticket, man.
Some hippies in an old school bus with a makeshift kitchen served questionable falafel to hungry partiers. The smell of Middle Eastern spices mingled with sweat, patchouli, marijuana, and the surrounding pine woods. It was like a psychedelic tailgate party. Finally, the time came for the main event, and the tranquil vibe spilled onto the hill, flowing to the stage. The band kicked off with Hell in a Bucket, and then wove their way through Althea, Deal, Terrapin Station, and Morning Dew. Eventually, the Grateful Dead scene became too much to manage and brought the annual gathering to an end. But for a decade, Deadheads came from all over the country to camp in the woods and experience the band's vision of love, sharing, and peaceful coexistence. And we got to hear them play songs fit for a hippie utopia on a hillside near the rolling farm fields of southeastern Wisconsin.
Steve Gotcher is a producer and technical director at Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now we can all use a reason to laugh and safely get out of the house these days. A new art exhibit on display in West Bend and Milwaukee has both. Wisconsin Funnies, 50 Years of Comics, features over 200 works by more than 30 Wisconsin artists, some serious, some funny, all a part of the state's rich history in comic strips and cartooning. Tyler Friedman is Associate Curator of Contemporary Art at the Museum of Wisconsin Art and a co-curator of the Wisconsin Funnies exhibit. Tyler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I understand, even going back further than 50 years, Wisconsin played a big role in the development of comics that, I got to admit, I didn't know about. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. The history is long and storied and is covered in pretty good detail by Paul Buell, who contributed an essay to the exhibition catalog, Wisconsin Funnies. It's a 250-page catalog with all the exhibition images. There were a number of early 20th century comic artists who are very well known. Claire Briggs, who put out a strip called A Piker Clerk and The Days of Real Sports. Frank King's Gasoline Alley as well. But I think the Wisconsin scene really kicks it into overdrive in the late 60s and early 70s with the underground comic movement. It was really spearheaded by a guy named Dennis Kitchen, who's a Racine native and then moved to Milwaukee, studied at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, was one of the co-founders of the Bugle American, which was an underground newspaper in the 1970s. And he had a publishing company called Kitchen Sink Press, which published a lot of the recognizable names in underground comics and also historical comics. He was reprinting important material that was otherwise inaccessible.
Well, walk us through the exhibit now. What are we going to see?
All sorts of things. 50 years of comics. we've split the exhibition for the first time in MOA's almost 60-year history between two locations. So our mothership location, as we like to call it, is in West Bend. In West Bend, we have sort of a retrospective overview of the past 50 years. So we have a lot of underground material from Dennis Kitchen. Jim Mitchell is another Milwaukee artist. Dan Burr, who lives in Bayview, is a well-known graphic novelist. We have works by Linda Berry, who in 2019 won one of the coveted illustrious MacArthur Genius Grant Awards. She's a colleague of Jeff Butler at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Jeff Butler, back in the 1980s, was drawing the comic Badger, a Madison-based superhero. We have science fiction work by Steve Rude, who was also based in Madison. We have a large selection of historical comics that are by artists who were not necessarily born, raised, or working in Wisconsin, but who Dennis republished. So Ernie Bushmiller, who drew Nancy for decades, Al Capp, who drew Little Abner, Milt Kniff, who drew Terry and the Pirates, Will Eisner, who drew Spirit, Robert Crumb, Trina Robbins, Harvey Kurtzman, who started Mad Magazine. There are a whole lot of people.
And people can see these at both locations, as you said, and I invite people to check in advance. There are some COVID-related safety precautions. For people further away, though, who can't make the trip, what kind of things can we see online?
Online. Well, I think if someone really wanted to engage with the exhibition from a distance, I would recommend ordering the catalog. I might be a little bit biased there. But as I said, all the images from the exhibition have been reproduced in glorious color. And then there's the essay by Paul Buell that I mentioned on a broad history of Wisconsin comics. And then a really great essay by one of the exhibition co-curators, Jim Banky, who is a historian and an archivist who worked at the Wisconsin Historical Society for 35 years. And he's written a great essay on the life and career of Dennis Kitchen. So between those two essays and between the exhibition catalog, I think readers would get a pretty good sense of Wisconsin's contributions to this important genre.
I know, again, a couple hundred pieces. I won't make you choose just one favorite, but could you highlight one of the things we would see at the exhibit that really stands out to you?
Oh, goodness.
I know, it's an unfair question.
That isn't, I wish I had I'd prepared a little bit better. I've been walking through the exhibition in my mind, and there are so many pieces. Linda Berry's work is really something special. I had mentioned she won the MacArthur Genius Grant But she uses, her work is multifaceted. She's got a really acute insight into the psychology of children and relationships and disappointments that people experience professionally speaking. And she also uses her work to try to liberate the creativity of your so refreshing that when you come away from Linda's work, you want to try your own hand at drawing comics.
Is that part of your hope for the exhibit, that like Linda Barry herself, you'll be able to inspire maybe a new generation of people to be creative, maybe even in the medium of comics?
Absolutely. I would say that holds for every exhibition that I'm a part of. I think one of the benefits of a museum is that it sparks the next generation of creativity. You see the great works of the past and the present, and those are all oriented towards the future. We're doing a number of programs during the run of the exhibition, and there will be several master classes with artists that are geared towards helping people become better cartoonists if they wish. Jeff Butler, who I had mentioned, will be leading one of those. We'll have a program for teens to make their own zines, the actual bookmaking part of things. So if people are interested in drawing, seeing the exhibition would be a great start, and then taking part in some of these programs would also be advisable.
Tyler, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tyler Friedman is Associate Curator of Contemporary Art at the Museum of Wisconsin Art. He talked with us about the new exhibit there, Wisconsin Funnies, 50 Years of Comics. It's on display now through November 22nd at locations in West Bend and Milwaukee. You can find out more how to check it out and some of those programs he talked about at their website. It's wisconsinart.org. Again, that's wisconsinart.org. Coming up, jokes about millennials and their love of avocados aside, the ancient fruit is definitely enjoying a high point in popularity right now. We'll dig into the past, present, and future of the tasty treat. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, the pandemic has raised a lot of big questions in medical ethics, from who gets priority when treatments or possible vaccines are limited to the use of unproven and untested medications. Kate Archer-Kent talks to an expert on medical ethics, and you can share your thoughts. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, avocados are not new. In fact, they've been around for millions of years, and they were a common part of the diet and cuisine in Mexico and the region before they gained wide popularity here in the U.S. And the avocado has now achieved a kind of rock star status lately in the food world.
The avocado! Thanks!
Excitement about avocados on Vine there. Jeff Miller, an associate professor of hospitality management at Colorado State University, is the author of a new book on the avocado. It's called Avocado, A Global History. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, avocados are big and worldwide now, but where did the kinds of avocado we came to know and love and eat come from?
Well, the avocado's home is in South Central Mexico in the state of Michoacan, and they have just spread around the Caribbean, down into South America, into America, and then around the world.
Now, we tend to eat them, I think, kind of like a vegetable, but avocados are a fruit, right?
Yeah, avocados are a single seed berry.
They're a berry.
They're a berry. That surprised me too when I was doing the research for this book.
Now, we humans like them, but we weren't the first ones to discover the avocado as a food source. You are right that avocados or their ancestors co-evolved with a lot of other big species in the Americas. Who are the animals that helped carry the avocado around?
Well, the avocados were spread by animals that we call the mega herbivores. And mega herbivores are big plant-eating animals The one that everybody would be familiar with today would be the elephant. It's this gigantic thing, but it lives entirely on vegetative matter. And in the late Pleistocene, when the avocado was kind of getting its legs, so to speak, the mega herbivores of Mesoamerica were things like the toxodon and the giant ground sloth and the giant armadillo. And somebody once said that the giant armadillo was an armadillo about the size of a UPS truck. So you can get a sense of how big these things were. And they would go around and just swallow. They're so big, they could just swallow an avocado whole and then digest it and then excrete the pit whole and undamaged. And that's how the avocado spread around.
And how big a part of the diet was the avocado for, I guess, pre-Columbian cultures in Central America?
The avocado was very big in these Central American cultures, starting from the very earliest cultures, the Olmecs, the Mayas especially. The Mayas and the Olmecs found out about the avocado, ran onto it very early, and started selecting it very early for size and productivity. And so doing a little bit of crop selection, so to speak. And for the Maya especially, they were very important. They had huge orchards of them. They're so important that they carved them on temples, carved them on graves. They even have a month. The Maya had a 14-month calendar, and one of the months was avocado month. So this is incredibly important for Central American cultures.
Talking to Jeff Miller about his new book, Avocado, A Global History. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're an avocado fan or an avocado hater, or if you have a question about how they became such a global phenomenon, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 642-1234. Jeff, I want to get into how they became so big here in the United States. There were efforts over a long period of time, but a pivotal moment you describe in your book was when avocado marketers decided that they were going to call this thing an avocado. Talk about that story a little bit.
Yeah, so in 1915, the California Aguacate Association had a meeting in a hotel in Los Angeles, and they had this thing they thought was the next million-dollar idea in food, but they didn't think that anybody would buy it if they called it an aguacate. And this is one of America's less savory historical episodes, unfortunately. There was a lot of anti-Mexican sentiment in Southern California at the time. And in fact, many places, there's a lot of Latinx, anti-Latinx sentiment. So the marketer said, "This is a really great thing, but you'll never sell it for big money, make it a premium item if it's associated with Mexicans." And so they put their heads together, did a little research, and found out that the first English settlers in Jamaica called it an avocat or an avocado, and they thought that sounded more sophisticated and more European and continental and less Mexican. And so they just made a vow right there that everybody was going to call it an avocado. In fact, if you called it anything else, like an alligator pear or an aguacate, and you remember the association, you got fined.
And they actually had to pressure the dictionaries of the time, you write, to get them to go with avocado on this.
Yeah, avocado was a new word that nobody really knew, so they had to go sell it to the dictionaries and make very sure that they didn't spell it with an ES, so it's avocados with just an S.
There are a lot of kinds of avocados out there, but today I think if anybody in the U.S. envisions an avocado, they picture the one we call the Haas avocado. Now, the developer of that, I'll ask you to share his story. He was born, though, in Milwaukee before he went on to make his career in avocado production in California. Can you share the story of the avocado that's become the avocado for a lot of us?
Oh, you bet. Yeah. Actually, it's pronounced Haas. Like
Haas. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you know, for a long time, I had a hard time training myself to say Haas because we've all called it the Haas. But it's a Haas. And yeah, Rudolph Haas was born in Milwaukee. And like so many people in the 1920s, was kind of taken with the lure of California, you know, that land of sunshine, that land of milk and honey. And California was going through that first big citrus boom, and grapefruit and oranges and all these things were coming out of there. So he went out west with his family and got a job with the post office in La Habra, California, and managed to cobble together a little money and decided that he was going to take a chance on these new avocado things that were coming out. And the big avocado of the day was the Fuerte, which was the first cold resistant avocado. And that was really a big step, finding avocados that could take a little bit of light frost. And so he's got this small orchard of these things, and he's trying to do a little grafting and do a little experimenting with different varieties. And so he buys some rootstock totally anonymously at a nursery and tries to graft on some root, use it for rootstock to graft on some other kinds of avocados. And this one piece of rootstock wouldn't take any grafts. And he even tried to kill it a couple of times. He said, well, if it won't take my grafts, I don't want. He tried to kill it and dig it out. And this was a hardy, tough little thing. And eventually his kid said, Dad, don't kill that. That's the best avocados that we have. They're so delicious. And so he tried them and agreed that he thought they were pretty good. And so he started taking them to sell to his friends at the post office and at a local store. Pretty soon they took off, and he thought he had something there, and he did. And he got the first, the Hass avocado is the first patented plant in America. And Hass makes a deal with a nursery to sell these patented plants. Well, growers didn't want to pay $2 or $3 for a Hass avocado start. And so they would buy one or two, and then they would just do what they call evade the patent, essentially steal it. And, you know, the Hass avocado, they said billions of them, billions of dollars worth of them every year. It's the single largest avocado in international trade. And Rudolf Hass never made enough money to quit the post office off of this. And he died about the year the patent expired, and he made about $5,000 on it in his lifetime.
We're talking to Jeff Miller right now, author of the new book, Avocado, A Global History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of avocados? Have you always liked them? Are you a recent convert? Do you have a question about avocados and their history, how they became so big? We'll start taking your calls in just a few moments here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Jeff Miller from Colorado State University, author of the new book, Avocado, A Global History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you pro-avocado? Do you not get the attraction to them? If you love them, how do you eat them? If you have a question about avocados, their history, their production, and more, call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Caleb is with us in Oconomowoc. Caleb, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering, I've had several people tell me to be wary of purchasing avocados from Mexico due to worker exploitation and like ties to drug cartel. I was just wondering if the speaker could talk about that.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. You do tackle that issue in your book.
Yes, I do. There are some problems associated with production coming out of Mexico. I personally try and eat mostly American avocados myself, but during one of Mexico's frequent purges, during one of their frequent times of pressure on the cartels, some of the cartels down there decided they needed to branch off into legitimate business, although they didn't necessarily get into these businesses legitimately. And so, yeah, some of the avocados that come out of Mexico are fairly well linked to the narcotraficante cartels. And they don't usually run the orchards themselves, but they extract taxes, as they call them, on the production and distribution of the avocados. And so it's, you know, I think in some instances you can definitely say that by buying Mexican avocados that, you know, you are indirectly in some way supporting the cartels. I don't want to make this sound like a blanket statement, because there's a lot of good growers down there and there's a lot of good distributors down there, but on the American market end of it, it's kind of hard to tell which avocado is which.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Rachel in West Allis. Rachel, hi.
Hi there. You may have already mentioned it while I was on hold or talking to the representative, but I wanted to say that a couple of years ago, I was going through my great-grandmother's cookbooks, and I found a recipe that referred to an avocado as an alligator pear. And I thought that was just the most fabulous thing ever because it's such a perfect description. And so I think we should call them alligator pears. And then I also wanted...
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I love avocados or alligator pears, and my favorite ways to eat them are just plain with a little bit of lemon juice and salt, or if you put them in a fruit smoothie, it makes it very rich and creamy, like ice cream.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing that, and that's a great encounter. Rachel likes the name alligator pear. I do, too. But boy, Jeff, the makers, the people who decided on avocado, the ones trying to sell these things, they hated that name.
Oh, yeah. You just made a 1920s avocado marketer roll over in their grave. They said, definitely do not call this an alligator pear. They said they don't look like an alligator, which is where I think mostly that term comes from. They said it doesn't look like an alligator. They're not eaten by alligators. There's nothing to do with alligators. And so you shouldn't call them an alligator pear. One of the things that was going on also in the 1920s that I don't think most people think about anymore is alligator was a term from the black jazz community that kind of denoted somebody who was worthless, who was actually a thief. And sometimes when the black jazz musicians would see white jazz musicians in the audience and then hear them use their licks later, they called them alligators. So this whole term alligator was kind of a thief or a worthless person. And the marketers knew that, and they did not want a product that they were getting big money for associated with any kind of reference like that. So, the guy's just rolling in his grave.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from a bunch of people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Scott, who says, split it, remove the pit, skin it, and eat. The avocado needs no help from other flavors. It tastes best on its own. Jeff, I think there's probably a divide between people like Scott who want it as is versus a lot of recipes mix it with a lot of different stuff.
Boy, what you mix it with an avocado with or eat it with is certainly all over the board. Today, you know, of course, the number one way to eat it is probably guacamole. So you've got a lot of sharp flavors in there to piquant things, you know, like some pepper or some lemon juice or some onion or even some cilantro and things like that. Or simple, the second biggest thing is probably avocado toast, or it's really simple. Although I've seen everything from, I like to say everything from anchovies to za'atar on avocado toast. It's all over the board. You know, the classic pairing with it is grapefruit in a salad. And for me, I don't think you can get any more decadent than putting shrimp louis inside an avocado half. That's luxury living for me.
That sounds pretty good. I want to spend our last couple minutes on the future of the avocado, Jeff. You write about sustainability concerns, about threats from a parasite, I think, to the Hass avocado. What are you watching for the future of the fruit?
You know, there's a lot of issues around the fruit. It's getting to be expensive to harvest in the United States. It's kind of a water waster. We think of the almond as a poster child for extravagant water use. It's going to be hard for it to go away. Climate change is going to be a big issue with it. It's already getting too hot in some parts of Australia and South Africa and too dry for it. So the future is tough. There's some other varieties out there that are much more eco-friendly than the Hass, but you know, most people have never heard of them, never seen them. They're green skins, which aren't popular. And to fight some of these things like fungal issues going on and water use and some of that stuff, they're already working on possibly genetically modifying avocados. But most people who eat avocados are want natural foods, back to nature. You know, people want healthful, clean, they want clean labels, right? And so it's going to be hard for the marketers to get us to accept genetically modified avocados. I think the best thing is to try and urge your produce people to bring in some different varieties so people can get used to having different varieties. And different times of year, there's different avocados that could be brought in and could be eaten.
Jeff, thanks a lot for being with us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's Jeff Miller, Associate Professor of Hospitality Management at Colorado State University and author of the book we've been talking about, Avocado, A Global History. You can still share your avocado thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We had some fans, as I mentioned. We had some non-fans. Andy writes, Would love to eat more of them, but I can't get past the texture. Margaret says, I avoid them at all costs. I find them tasteless. The texture is like eating butter. Maybe they're like cilantro, Margaret says, and that 50% of people love them. 50% are like me and find nothing worth eating. Again, share your thoughts on the avocado over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with an ongoing series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. Brian Vagley operates a 166-year-old dairy farm near New Glarus. As the pandemic stretches on, his days look mostly the same, but he worries about what could happen if the virus puts him or his workers out of commission.
So far, I'm happy to say that we have not had anyone personally test positive for COVID-19. I would say that just given time and opportunity that we'll probably all face some chance or exposure of COVID-19. The one thing that we're lucky at this point is that summertime, most of our jobs are outside. Many of our jobs are people being alone or separated from other people. However, there are numerous jobs that still require some close contact with other people, but we've been able at this point to avoid anything. We're lucky enough that we're able to harvest crops, plant crops, get along. It would be absolutely devastating for an industry like ours that has to be there 24/7, that has to take care of animals, that has to be caretakers, food providers, and everything else. If we had an outbreak, we're not exactly sure how we would handle all the chores and jobs necessary to maintain our dairy operation. It does feel a little bit like Groundhog's Day in the fact that I've been here every day, and so have a couple of my other workers. We're always concerned about what the future brings. When and if the pandemic hits here, how we'll be able to handle it, if we are prepared enough for it. We're always concerned about the economic downturn and what could happen again, because we were fortunate enough that to have the government provide a lot of programs and assistance on this first run through. My guess is we won't have the same opportunities the next time around. So we are trying to plan, try to be prepared for another rise in it, in the pandemic, and hopefully we'll be able to ride that storm out as well.
We have been able to survive through this. We worry every day about when COVID-19 respikes, as it is already. We have missed many events that we normally do. We were able to go to 2 cattle shows this summer, where normally by this time we might have gone to 5 or 6 with several more on the docket. We try to stay safe. We continue to do what we do every day. And we hope everybody else is safe. And please care about everyone.
You can see all these stories at WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, President Trump issued a series of executive orders billed as COVID-19 economic relief efforts, but there are big questions over his authority to make those decisions. We'll check out the orders and the constitutional questions they raise. Social media sites have blocked political ads over misleading content. The Trump campaign is suing a Rhinelander TV station over an ad. We'll look at campaign ads and whether media outlets should screen them for false content. And is American agriculture sustainable in the long run? The author of the new book, Perilous Bounty, says we need some big changes to maintain our food supply. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, it can be easy to pick up a bad habit and a lot harder to break it. It's not just you. It's part of the way we're wired as humans. Kate and her guests look at the science of bad habits and find out how to use the latest research to make changes in our lives. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Amazon broke all-time profit and revenue records last quarter, even after spending several billion dollars cleaning warehouses and hiring lots more workers. We'll talk about the rise and rise of Amazon and why the company faces criticism over monopoly practices and warehouse working conditions. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.